Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet David Trinidad. David Trinidad's most recent book of poetry, The Late Show, was published in 2007 by Turtle Point Press. His anthology, Saints of Hysteria, A Half Century of Collaborative American Poetry, co-edited with Denise Duhamel and Maureen Seaton, was also published in 2007 by Soft Skull Press. His other books include Plasticville and Phoebe, 2002, an essay in verse. Trinidad teaches poetry at Columbia College, Chicago, where he co-edits the journal Court Green. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, Jan. Hi.
Hi. I'm really ecstatic to have you here. You're going to read a number of poems from several of your books.
Yes.
Right. So go ahead. Start wherever you'd like.
Okay. I wrote this poem in 1995. Ira is my ex-partner, you should know that, and Byron was our dog, a Cairn Terrier. Red Parade. Depressed because my book wasn't nominated for a gay award, I lie on the couch watching, not listening to, the OJ trial. Byron, who senses something's wrong, hides under the bed until Ira comes home, carrying a bouquet of beautifully wrapped tulips. I press the mute button. "This is your prize," he says. "Guess what they're called?" A smile involuntarily overcomes my frown. "What?" "Red Parade." "That sounds like the name of an old Barbie outfit," I say. "That's exactly what I told the florist. And you know what she told me?" "What?" "When she was a girl, she turned her Barbie into Cleopatra, gave her an Egyptian haircut, and painted her nipples blue." "How cool." "Yeah, but now she thinks that her doll would be worth $800 if she hadn't messed it up." Once in water, the tulips begin to unclench, 10 angry fists. Their colors are fierce, like Plath's great African cat, her bowl of red blooms. Poor Sylvia, who so desperately wanted awards and only won them after she was dead. Byron jumps up. Ira sits down and massages my feet. "You guys." My spirits are lifted by their tulips, kisses, licks. Chatty Cathy was a doll made by Mattel in the 1960s. You'd pull a string at the back of her neck and she'd talk to you. Because she only said about a dozen things and often repeated herself, I thought she'd be a perfect subject for a villanelle. Chatty Cathy Villanelle. "When you grow up, what will you do? Please come to my tea party. I'm Chatty Cathy. Who are you? Let's take a trip to the zoo. Tee-hee, tee-hee, tee-hee. You're silly. When you grow up, what will you do? 1 + 1 = 2. It's fun to learn your ABCs. I'm Chatty Cathy. Who are you? Please help me tie my shoe. Can you come out and play with me? When you grow up, what will you do? The rooster says cock-a-doodle-doo. Please read me a bedtime story. I'm Chatty Cathy. Who are you? Our flag is red, white, and blue. Let's make believe you're mommy. When you grow up, what will you do? I'm Chatty Cathy. Who are you?" This is a series of haiku based on TV shows from the 60s. I think all of these shows, even Honey West, are enjoying a second or maybe even a third life on DVD. Reruns. Splash. Like a rock, Ellie Mae's cake sank to the bottom of the cement pond. In outer space, Judy Jetson spins a disc and does the orbit to Comet of Love. With a little grin, Morticia snipped off the rose and placed the stem in the tombstone-shaped vase. Patty to Kathy. "While you study as me, I'll leave as you, then go as me on my date." Housework. Samantha looked at the dirty dishes. Just this once, she thought, and twitched. New Year's Eve, the cork popped off the bottle, and effervescent, Jeannie overflowed. Honey in the flesh, she knew how to use her high-voltage curves like an unconcealed weapon. Batman and Robin hang by threads above a bubbling vat of acid, to be continued. Model children. Kitten told the truth. Princess set aside her pride. Bud made right his wrong. Island girls. Mary Ann dons one of Ginger's dresses, but it falls flat on her chest. Gossip. Gidget and LaRue knock heads as they press their ears to the prince's phone. Fred's breakfast. With a club, Wilma cracked open the 3-minute pterodactyl egg. Puberty. Wally pounds on the bathroom door. Come on, Beeve, you've been in there for hours. Fractured fairy tale. This kissing princess was such a dog that the frog she smacked simply croaked. Green Acres. The smoke from Lisa's burnt pancakes slowly blackens the fresh country air. The Mod Squad. Julie, Pete, and Link bust some thugs, then head back to their pad to turn on. Like bird or balloon, Sister Bertrill fades to a speck in the blue sky above San Tanco. Actually, I think the only show that's not out on DVD yet is the Patty Duke show. And of course, that's the show I most want to have on DVD.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet David Trinidad, reading his work. So you really were fixated on Patty Duke?
Yes. In a big way. I have many Patty Duke poems.
Really?
Yes.
Are you going to read some?
I could. I wasn't planning to, but I actually could.
Can you read one?
Sure.
Okay.
And since the show isn't out on DVD yet, this will serve as a sort of guide. The 10 best episodes of the Patty Duke show. 1. Patty cheats on a computerized intelligence test and is pronounced a genius. 2. Ross blackmails Patty and Kathy by tape recording their conversation at a slumber party. 3. Patty is cast as Cleopatra in the school play, but gets stage fright on opening night. 4. Patty writes a novel entitled I Was a Teenage Teenager. 5. Kathy wears Patty's expensive new dress to a piano concert and accidentally spills punch on it. 6. Patty and Kathy run against each other for class president. 7. Frankie Avalon's car breaks down in front of the Lane house. 8. Patty raffles a date with Richard for the church bazaar, then gets jealous and tries to buy all the tickets back. 9. Patty's tonsils are taken out by a dreamboat doctor, played by Troy Donahue. 10. Patty pretends to be Kathy and flirts with Richard to see if he'll be faithful to her.
Thank you. Thank you.
Patty and Kathy, by the way, were identical cousins. And they often
pretended. They laugh alike. They talk alike.
They often pretended to be each other. Right?
Okay. So I want to ask you, I'm glad you read that one, because I wanted to ask you about this listing that happens in your poems often, and if you see that as related to that time period of the 60s and 70s in any way, and in some kind of replication or sense of fun that you relate to that time period.
Well, you know, I don't know that I relate it to that time period per se. I think it's connected more to my own obsessiveness, you know, and just the sort of joy of cataloging and collecting together this information. And so I think that's the appeal for me. And I notice that I'm never able to put everything in. You know, the desire is to make it all fit, or as much of it as possible, mm-hmm. all that information, you know, and even trivia, like mm-hmm. in this case, you know, and actually, you know, that poem, the Patty Duke show was being shown on Nick at Night. Mm-hmm. I guess this would have been the early 90s, and I recorded all of them, or all but a couple. I mean, there were three episodes I wasn't able to get, and I actually wrote down the plot of each one, so I had this list, and then I typed up the list, and then I narrowed it down to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're not my absolute favorite episodes, but that's sort of the conceit of the poem, but... Just to make an arrangement that was pleasing in some way for mm-hmm. me. You know.
Well, can you talk about that fascination with collecting and cataloging, and is it in relationship, I guess, to your obsession with that time period, mm-hmm. the 60s and 70s?
Well, yeah, it's the obsessions, you know, the things that I'm drawn to write about are actually... things from my childhood, you know, that had that there's some sort of emotional connection or fixation with, like say the Patty Duke show or Barbie dolls or Yardley makeup, which was a line of makeup for teenage girls in the 60s. So much of it is sort of, you know, stuff that was forbidden to me. You know, it has to do with girls, and since I was a boy, I wasn't supposed to be interested in that stuff. So I think that's the draw, the emotional draw for me. But then, of course, the challenge to, you know, to sort of turn that into art some way, mm-hmm. into poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to fit somehow for me.
It does. Yeah. I mean, the listing, you know, fits that idea of recalling things. Mm-hmm. And the cataloging is obsessive, but it's interesting because the poems don't feel obsessive to me at all.
That's interesting.
You know, maybe the process, but the poems feel, there's such a nice sense of accessibility. I mean, not in an easy way, but, you know, I feel like we have entry into your poems, and maybe part of that is because we can recognize those references.
Mm-hmm.
But the listing also enables that access, I think.
You know, it's funny because I have a poem. I won't read it today. It's too long. But this poem called "Meet the Supremes," which was about my fixation with girl groups from that time period. And in the middle of the poem is a long list of just the names of girl groups and singers. And it's a fun. I think it's a fun list. You know, and you know, with the Mermaids and the Honeybees, and you know, it just goes on and on. And someone one of the first times I ever read it, someone said, who knew the poems, told me, when you get to the list of girl groups, just read each one as if it were a candy, as if, you know, and that, I thought that was really great advice, you know, and that, and so a lot of times when I read lists in poems, I think of that, like, you know, just it's meant to be pleasurable in some way.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know?
All right.
I like that candy. You
it
know?
Is, it is. Okay.
And I was smiling when I was reading the 10 best episodes of the Patty Duke show, just because that just gives me pleasure. To, mm-hmm. You know.
Okay. Could you read more?
Sure. And ironically, the one I was going to read next is a list, a poem. So it's the title poem of my new book, The Late Show. It's circa the early 70s, when I was still in high school, and in those pre-VHS days, one of the few ways you could see an old movie was if you caught it on The Late Show on television. And of course, there were only about a dozen channels at that time. So this is from memory. The Late Show. Natalie Wood, in the middle of reciting a Wordsworth poem, bursts into tears and runs out of the classroom. Carol Baker gasps in an oxygen tent, her platinum Harlow hair damp and flat. Kim Stanley throws a champagne glass at her mother's taxi, screaming, "There is no God, there is no God." In a chiffon cocktail dress and ankle straps, Joan Crawford staggers down the beach, convinced her lover, Jeff Chandler, is out to murder her. Lana Turner learns that she and her daughter, Sandra Dee, are in love with the same man. Jilted and demented, Susie Parker crouches in an alleyway in a soiled trench coat, sifting through Louis Jourdan's trash. To avoid forging the signature of her twin sister, whom she's killed, Betty Davis grabs the red-hot end of a fire iron with her writing hand. Doris Day, in a black lace peignoir, sobs into the telephone, "Who are you? Why are you doing this to me?" Julie Harris hears Hill House beckoning, beckoning. Geraldine Page begs Paul Newman for a fix. Simone Signore wipes her fingerprints off the glass as James Caan collapses, dead at her feet. Lee Remick pours herself another drink. Trembling, Ingrid Bergman watches the gas lights dim. Shirley MacLaine breaks down, admits her attraction to Audrey Hepburn. Barbara Stanwyck tries to keep Capucine. Elizabeth Taylor scrawls with lipstick, "No sale," across a mirror. Deborah Carr smolders. Shelley Winters shrieks. Kim Novak screams and backs out of the bell tower into thin air. You know, when I, like I said, that poem was written from memory, and one of the movies that wasn't available at the time I wrote that, that I later got a hold of, a video of, was this movie Games. And it's where Simone Signore poisons James Caan. And I was very upset to learn that he collapses on a bed. He doesn't collapse at her, on her, you know, at her feet. And just that, but that little factual inaccuracy sort of bugged me. But then I thought, well, it was written from, that's why I said it was written from memory.
Cause it's not exact. You mean when you saw the movie?
That I had remembered it incorrectly.
You wanted something more dramatic. You wanted him to fall on the floor? Or
no, I just wanted it to be accurate to what really happened in the movie.
Oh, okay.
You see?
Okay.
I guess that's more obsessiveness, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but then I don't. It's interesting to me because we don't always remember things correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they certain things have an effect on us and we have a memory of it. And then we can later learn that it's not exactly what really happened.
Well, what if it made a better poem? You know, would you change those details of the movie of a movie to make the poem better?
Well, I think poems, like I think Anne Sexton said, poems will force you to lie, and so I've always sort of believed in that. And that, yeah, if it makes the poem better, it doesn't have to be accurate.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that, but I just because you seem so interested in having it be correct for the movie, I wondered if you'd be willing to lie about these movies, you know?
Yes, I guess I would be willing to lie.
Okay.
But I wasn't trying to lie in that poem.
Okay. But you would.
I would, yes.
Okay, good.
It doesn't have to be absolutely correct.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Could you read a few more for
sure.
us?
It's funny, you know, I didn't set out to read a lot of list poems because I write other sorts of poems, but here's another list poem. This poem is composed of movie titles. Since childhood, I've been enamored of things mass-produced, and so I've always had a kind of disdain for the natural world, though that has changed as I've gotten older. Nature poem. Till the clouds roll by, a patch of blue. How green was my valley, splendor in the grass. The petrified forest, the river of no return, lilies of the field, the bad seed. A tree grows in Brooklyn, autumn leaves, lost horizon, gone with the wind. James Schuyler. I went to his 66th birthday dinner 16 years ago this past November. I remember that it was at Chelsea Central, his favorite restaurant, Great Steaks, on 10th Avenue, and that Ashbury was there, and a few others, including Joe, impeccably dressed and gracious, who picked up what must have been, I thought at the time, an exorbitant bill. I remember him saying more than once, "Joe always picks up the bill," then smiling a slightly wicked smile. Sitting with him, those excruciating silences in his room at the Chelsea, my eyes would wander from his bookshelves. The portrait of a lady stood out, to the pan of water on the radiator, to the records strewn on the floor, to some scraggly plants, ivy, herbs, in ceramic pots at the base of the French doors that open to the balcony and balustrade and sound of traffic on 23rd Street, six floors below. He read me White Boat, Blue Boat shortly after he wrote it, and a poem about Brooke Benton singing Rainy Night in Georgia that didn't make it into his last poems, though I remember thinking it beautiful. He complained in a letter to Tom about how much I smoked and how emotional I'd get during movies. He must have been referring to Field of Dreams. He had a yen for Kevin Costner. When he took me to see L'Atlante, a film he loved, I was bored. Once, we took the subway, he hadn't ridden it in years, to the Frick. I remember admiring Romney's Lady Hamilton. It hurt that he didn't invite me to the dinner after his Dia reading, or to the reception after his reading at the 92nd Street Y, though he did, at the latter, read Mood Indigo, dedicated to me. When he said my name from the stage, Joan and Eileen, sitting to my left, turned and stared at me. Frozen by the enormity of the moment, I couldn't look back. When he came to a reading I gave at St. Mark's, Raymond impressed upon me what an honor it was. Jimmy didn't go to many poetry readings. What else is there to say? That when I visited him at St. Vincent's the day before he died, Dara said, he likes to hear gossip. So I said, Eileen and I are talking again. That at his funeral I sat alone, Ira couldn't come. That was the loneliest feeling in the world. That afterwards Doug said, you look so sad. How should I have looked, Doug? And that a year after he died, I dreamt I saw him in the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel. He was wearing a hospital shift and seemed to have no muscle control over his face, like in intensive care after his stroke. He saw me and said, it's nice to see some familiar faces. I approached him, but he disappeared.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet David Trinidad. I really like that poem.
Thanks.
Yeah, there's such a tenderness in there, and, you know, in some of the other list, more fun sort of poems you were reading, there's such a lightness. You have a great range in your work.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny about that, the poem for Jimmy Schuyler. I don't know why I stuttered there. You know, it's like I remember when I had such admiration for him. He was a great poet, and he had a big effect on my work. And when we first became friends, he said, well, call me Jim. You know, so I'm like, and it was like a big honor, but also very difficult, you know. And
yeah.
Like, you know. But, you know, I wrote the poem in an attempt to sort of say goodbye to him, but the poem wouldn't let, like, he ends up saying goodbye to me, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's funny that you think you're going to do something in a poem and the poem doesn't quite let you do it, you know, or the poem has a mind of its own, you know.
That's right. But it seems to me, I don't know if you'd call it this, but in all your poems, there's an easy sort of voice. I don't mean easy as in facile, but, you know, a voice that welcomes us in, and maybe it's the, we get it, just a sense of the person speaking in the present moment that is, makes it seem more alive and vibrant. Would you say that's right?
Well, I'm glad that you feel that way, and that yes, that's my goal. Or, you know, I'm glad that is so. You know, when I first started writing, which was a long time ago in the 70s, Anne Stanford, who I studied with in California, said something. I think it was her who said, you know, you have to seduce the reader. And that seemed like, of course, a heavy task to perform, you know. So, like, how do you do that? How do you seduce the reader? But that seemed right. Or at least, you know, by seduce, I I take that to mean, you know, like engage,
right,
or
right.
interest, you know. And, and that's what I guess I should speak for myself, you know, that I've always hoped to accomplish that. And I know that I do, but it's just, it's still mysterious. Like you can't.
Right. It's always mysterious.
Yeah.
Well, it's, I think we have time for another poem.
Okay. Since I read the poem, the Late Show poem, I'll read the sort of companion piece to that, which is watching the late movie with my mother. It was our special time, just the two of us alone in the family room on a Saturday night. Everybody else, my father, brother, and two younger sisters, asleep in the back of the house. She reclined on the brown couch. I was sprawled on the carpet in front of the TV, totally absorbed in the drama on the small screen. Elizabeth Taylor in a white slip, Paul Newman on crutches, arguing in an upstairs bedroom. Natalie Wood and Carolyn Jones sneaking off from their summer camp and canoeing by moonlight to the adult resort across the lake. Or Tippi Hedren tiptoeing away from her boss's safe, her beige pump slowly slipping out of her coat pocket. My mother lay there in her lavender bathrobe, head propped on a couple of throw pillows, with her double chin and her salt and pepper hair, bags under her eyes, easily moved to tears by love or death scenes. During a used car commercial, I fixed popcorn in the kitchen, poured it into the large green Tupperware bowl, quickly added melted butter and salt as not to miss a minute of the movie. I scooped a small bowl for my mother, grabbed napkins, set a glass of ice water on a cork coaster on the table next to the couch. Often, she fell asleep before the end and I'd have to nudge her. The movie's over, Mom. Go to bed. Once alone, I quietly unlocked the kitchen door and snuck outside, my cigarettes tucked in the pocket of my plaid robe. In the driveway, I smoked several in a row, ducking behind a hedge whenever a car came by, its headlights sweeping the dark street. Occasionally, a dog barked on another block. Dew shimmered on the dichondra in our front yard. I looked up at the moon, the trees, what stars I could see through the glow of the city in the distance. I inhaled the last drags deeply, doused the butt in curb water. Then, as frightened and excited as Marjorie Morningstar or Marnie, I tiptoed back into the house.
It's the poetry of David Trinidad. That last poem is from his latest book entitled The Late Show. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having me, Jan. It was great.
It was great and fun. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner, Ben Cole, and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.